So yeah, today I'm going to talk about some basic results on what kinds of joint probability distributions for various different kinds of probing schemes are compatible with a given causal structure. So as I mentioned in the first lecture, that kind of pattern in inferences looks a bit like this, that you can deduce from some hypotheses about the causal structure. You can often deduce constraints on what sorts of probability distributions are compatible with that. And then when you violate those constraints, that gives you some information about what, that allows you to possibly falsify your hypothesis, and so you can make some progress. So I'm going to be talking mostly today about some of the inferences from causal structure to these sorts of constraints. Not all such constraints, but just some of them. So let's start very simple. And talk about how the statistical parameters of the model, so the way that certain unobserved variables are distributed, for example, and functional dependencies, things like that, how those are constrained by the causal structure. So the simplest example of that is when you have some variables in your causal model that don't have any common ancestry. So they don't have parents in common or grandparents in common, that sort of thing. And in that case, they're modeled by a source that factorizes. So if two variables, x and y, have no common ancestry in your causal structure, then we say x is marginally independent of y, so conditionally independent given the empty set, which can be written in many forms, including the fact that the joint distribution of xy factorizes, like we saw last time. And so in terms of these sorts of diagrams I've been using, if I have x and y with no common cause in the past, then I say, well, the distribution over x, the distribution from which x is sampled and the distribution from y is sampled, it's a factorizing distribution rather than some dependent or correlated distribution. And the reason this is plausible is that if you want to imagine that these things are correlated, you need some reason, some causal explanation of that. So Hans Reichenbach, a philosopher, advocated the idea that if you have sources that are correlated, then there should be a causal explanation. It should be either cause-effect related or common cause related. So this is, you can think of this as an instance of that sort of thing, an instance. And if you imagine that you have two different coins and you're sort of flipping one coin and flipping the other coin, it's reasonable to imagine that the distribution that you're sampling from, because of course you don't know all the details of the coin flip, so you're not going to be able to predict exactly how the coin comes up every time. But your distributions for the pair of coins aren't going to have correlations. There's just going to be a bias for the one and a bias for the other that's represented by each of these distributions. Okay, so this is usually a very uncontroversial assumption about causal models, that all these variables should be independently distributed. But it means that one of the things we mentioned last time, we can now justify in terms of this assumption. So I'm going to revisit why it is that causal mechanisms and their inputs should be modeled as statistically independent. So last time I mentioned that if I have a situation where there's x, which then causes y via some deterministic function here, so f, capital F will be the name of the function, that y is some function of x. And in general, it could be that what I know about that function and what I know about how x is prepared could be correlated. But I said that typically we assume that in causal modeling that those distributions factorize. And so how do you justify this in terms of the independence of these nodes that have no common ancestors? Well, I also mentioned last time that any variability in a function, like f over here, can be thought of this way, that there's some fixed function of y on x, but also some other variables u. And u essentially is like a program that tells y how to depend on x. So y is some fixed function g of x and u, but as I vary the value of u, I can vary over all possible functions from x to y. So if x and y are bits, for example, and there's only four possible functions from a bit to a bit, as we saw at the end of last time, well, then u just needs to be a four-valued variable. And then for the different possible values of u, I get the four possible functions from x to y. So I can always do that. And therefore, uncertainty about what function holds here can always be modeled as uncertainty about the value of that extra control variable u. And so then we're back to a situation where I have two variables, x and u, and I presume that they have no common ancestry, so I can assume that they're independently distributed, which is the assumption we had a couple of slides ago. So that gets me back, you know, if these guys are independently distributed, then I can just compute the distribution over f from this distribution over u, and I find that these, that what I know about the function and x should also be independent. Okay, let me pause there for any questions. Clear? Okay. Good. So if I there's a terminology in the causal inference literature of a structural equation model. So when every variable depends on its parents through some deterministic function, you can think of that as a structural equation. I believe that's the terminology that economists use. And so if I have a structural equation model where an x causes y, well, x might not be the only cause of y. There will be some other variables, which here I'm calling u, which form the set of all causes of y, and y is now determined by some function of all those variables. So this would be a structural equation model. And then, as usual, we have to stipulate, you know, what do we know about each of these variables, like x and u. And here, g is fixed. So this notion, by the way, I should have mentioned on the last slide, this notion of imagining that variabilities in causal mechanisms is due to the variability in some variable with a fixed function, that's very natural from a fixed physics point of view, because it's saying that, you know, although I can think of dynamics as being due to sort of different effective Hamiltonians that a particle might see, ultimately I can always model that as some fundamental Lagrangian and some, you know, kinematic state of the context of the particle that determines, you know, what kinds of dynamics it sees. Okay, so this is in the causal inference literature called a structural equation model. The way you'll usually see it is not in terms of these circuits that I've been using a lot in the last lecture, but in terms of directed acyclic graphs like this one. So the same model as this one, when represented by a directed acyclic graph, is just of this form. So remember, the translation is that the wires in the circuit become the nodes in the DAG. And you know, here y has x and u as its causal parents. So here I have arrows from x and u into y. And I need to stipulate, in addition to the DAG, what the functional equations are. So those are what the term structural equation refers to. So y is this particular function of x and u. And then I need to stipulate the statistical distribution from which u and x are sampled in this particular model. And different models correspond to, you know, or different instances of a model correspond to different choices of these distributions or different choices of that function. Okay, so mostly I'm going to be using the circuits again, but occasionally and towards the end of the lecture, we'll be using these DAGs instead. All right, so another kind of simplification in the notation, which is often used, is, you know, rather than stipulating a deterministic function and lack of information about these extra variables u, I can just lump all of that as some conditional probability, right? So if I take, how does y depend on x? Well, y depends on x through the function g of x and u, but there's a probability distribution over u. I marginalize over u, I get some effective stochastic map from x to y. So I talked about this at the end of last time. Sometimes this stochastic map has less information than this distribution does. I can't go back. I cannot distinguish different probability distributions over functions that are all consistent with the same stochastic map. So you lose information when you go from this description to this description. But this is one of the conventional descriptions that people use when they're talking about causal models. So often when they stipulate their model, they don't stipulate a distribution over u and a functional dependence, but rather just a conditional y given x. All right, so given what I was talking about last time, you know, how important it is to kind of unscramble the causal and the inferential concepts, this is a bit of an omelet, because this p of y given x folds together causal facts, like what's the function, and facts about your knowledge, you know, what do you know about you? So this is why I've sort of put this box in blue. It's somehow capturing some stuff, like the vertical stuff here, which is causal, some stuff about your knowledge, and it's lumping it together into one object. Okay, but you should remember that it's not really what you're after. You know, if you want to know what's going on causally, you'd really ultimately like to know what those functions are, but sometimes you just can't get there. And so this is essentially all you can hope to reconstruct. And so people often find it useful to think of this as one of the parameters of their model, which you're trying to estimate from your data, simply because you can't get at the deeper information. Okay, so I'm going to use the term Bayesian causal model for this sort of thing. And as I said, this is a structural equation model. So that's the jargon I'm going to use to distinguish these two kinds of approaches. All right. And sometimes, you know, just it can be convenient to have sort of a name for this process of losing the information about what the distribution over functions is and just moving to the conditional. And it's a kind of quotienting operation where you're saying, well, I'm going to consider all distributions over functions that give the same stochastic map as equivalent. And I'm going to sort of quotient with respect to that equivalence relation and not worry anymore about where that stochastic map came from. All right, so if I, you know, if we consider these two kinds of models and the two kinds of depictions of them, so we have the circuit versions on top and the DAG versions on the bottom. In the language of DAGs, a structural equation model is one where every variable has all of its parents included in the DAG, right? So that I can stipulate for each variable how it depends on its parents in a totally deterministic way. It's given by a function. But if I'm doing a Bayesian causal model, variables don't need to have all their parents in the DAG, and I can get away with just stipulating a probabilistic dependence of a variable on its parents. So in this example, you know, y can depend probabilistically on x, because I'm imagining that there's some extra variable u, which it does depend deterministically on, but I don't know u. And when I take that all into account, there's just some conditional left over. So this is, you know, in some of the literature, this is sort of the most conventional way of doing things. You describe your parameters as these conditional probabilities of every variable given its parents. And certainly in the first lecture, when I showed a few different examples, that's exactly what I described as, you know, the causal model for the Bell structure and the instrumental structure in the triangle. Okay, but just it's useful to remember that in the background, you really have a functional dependence. Good. All right, so that's the simplest case. You know, we talked about what happens when you have variables that are, you know, no common ancestry. Now I want to go to a more complicated case, where I have x as a complete common cause of y and z, and I want to show that in that case, y and z are conditionally dependent given z. So if you believe that, you know, you have a certain causal structure, then you should assign these kinds of probability distributions. Okay, so this is sometimes also attributed to Reichenbach, this idea that when z is a complete common cause of x and y, then x and y might be dependent, but if I condition on z, if I learn the complete common cause, then they become independent. And remember, there's lots of ways of writing down this conditional dependence relation. This is one of them. The joint distribution of x and y given z factorizes. But it's going to be convenient for me to actually write it in a slightly different way, right? So if I multiply both sides of this equation by the marginal on z, then the left-hand side just becomes the joint distribution over x, y, z, and I pick up an extra p of z here. So this is also a perfectly good expression for conditional independence. Okay, so let's see why it is that you should organize your beliefs this way when you believe that z is a complete common cause of x and y. So the point is that if what I mean by complete common cause is that x is the only thing that's a non-trivial cause of y and z, and there are no other systems that are both that are non-trivial causes of both y and z, right? All that has to be in x. And now remember, last lecture I gave a definition of, you know, what it means for something to not have an influence on something else. So the function, so here I'm just repeating that slide. The function f that determines y from its causal antecedents has a trivial dependence on x. That's the definition. And the way, you know, I depicted it in terms of circuits was that, you know, a particular input that has no influence on the output basically is just ignored, and the output is a function of the other input. So that's what we're going to do. We're going to say, suppose that only x influences y and z. It means that these other variables, whatever they are, you know, this one here, for instance, could not have any influence on z, because then I would have to lump it into x. This one here cannot have any influence on y, because if it did, I should lump it into x. So I'm only going to be left, of all the other variables in the world, I'm going to be left with some that only influence y, some that only influence z. Everything else that influences both is part of the definition of x. So let me just give those guys names, lambda y and lambda z. That's everything else that's a parent of y or z, but isn't part of the complete common cause of y and z. Right? So there's no loss of generality. I can always find all the parents and organize them into these three sets. And f and g, of course, are the way that y and z depend deterministically on their pair of parents. Okay, so now we know what we mean by z being a complete common cause of y, sorry, x being a complete common cause of y and z in this classical causal model. So why should an agent who's rational organize their beliefs such that the only states of belief they're willing to have about x, y, and z are ones that have this form? That's the question we're trying to answer. Okay, so here I'll first give you sort of just an algebraic version of the proof. So regardless of the causal structure, if you just tell me I have a joint distribution over x, y, z, but there's these five variables out in the world, well, the joint distribution of x, y, z is just whatever you believe about those five variables marginalized over lambda y and lambda z. Okay, so that's just what I mean by the marginal distribution on x, y, z. And as we saw last time, anything like this, a joint distribution of five variables, can always be rewritten as yz given the other three times the marginal distribution on the other three. Again, nothing to do with causal structure. That's just something we can always do in probability theory. It's part of the definition of a conditional probability that I can rewrite a joint in terms of a conditional and the marginal. Okay, so I haven't used the causal structure at all. Next step is I'm going to start using facts about the causal structure. So the first thing to note is that the joint distribution over lambda y, lambda z, and x, well, these guys, if I'm confident that these three variables don't have any common ancestry, then that first assumption we made at the beginning said that the joint distribution of them, there's no reason to imagine any correlations, so I imagine that they factorize. Okay, so that's the first thing we need. And the second thing is the most important part, which is that this term here, right, it says, what do you know about y and z given the other three? Well, y and z are deterministic functions of these three, okay? And so I can always write this conditional probability is really just a deterministic inference. It says, if you give me the values of these three variables, then the values of the other two are completely specified, right? There's no uncertainty about them. And is given by this deterministic inference, right? That from x and lambda x, I can perfectly infer the value of y. This is just a Kronecker delta y, comma, f of x and lambda x. So that should be a lambda y. Sorry, yes, that's a typo. That should be a lambda y. And yeah, I don't think the typo appears anywhere else. Yeah, just there. So yeah, that's the deterministic dependence of y on these guys, the deterministic dependence of z on these guys. And note in particular that if you tell me that y and z depend deterministically on their parents so that it's a deterministic inference, then it always factorizes. That's the thing about deterministic inferences. They factorize, right? These are probability 0 or 1, each of them. And so I get a factorization here, and that's what's really critical for this proof. So I go on, I say, all right, I plug in each of these expressions into here, and you know, I've just put this product of Kronecker deltas, put this, and now I can just reorganize terms and notice that the only things, so this again should be lambda y, the only things that depend on lambda y are this and this, so I can lump them together. The only things that depend on lambda z are this term and this term, and then I have lambda probability distribution over x left over. So this is just the definition of p of y given x, right? I've marginalized over lambda y, so I'm just asking, what can I infer about y given x when I marginalize over lambda y? And similarly, this becomes p of z given x, and this is just the p of x that's left over. So I've derived the result we described on the previous page. And it's important here that, you know, causation is fundamentally deterministic. That's what I've really used in this proof.
So you said
Yes.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but you just said because there is no reason for us to think they're dependent, maybe assume they're independent, or we could say that because if they were dependent, we could lump them together again and say that this is a new x, could both affect y and z, therefore we could say that lambda y and lambda z and x are dependent.
Yeah, so the I guess what we're imagining here is that the other variables that influence y in addition to this complete common cause x, common cause of y and z, are really determined by a mechanism that's independent of the mechanism that fixes x. If there were some mechanism that influenced both, then I think x would not count as the complete common cause. I would have to then go further back in time, find that other variable, and do this analysis for that variable. Yeah. Good. So I should mention that, you know, questions like what variable is the complete common cause of these things, it is dependent on sort of what variables you're including in your model, right? And so you say, of the variables in my model, which ones act as a common cause of these ones? Which ones act as a mediator between these other ones? Okay, good. So this is the algebraic version, but let me show you kind of in the circuit formalism how this looks, because it's kind of intuitive. So, you know, remember in the circuit formalism we said, look, the vertical black wires here, that's the causal structure. And then the blue is sort of what I know. So in this case, I'm going to want to know what should I believe about x, y, and z. So I'm going to pull off these wires to say these are the three variables I'm interested in describing my beliefs for. And what I start off with is knowledge of the distribution over lambda y, the distribution over x, and the distribution over lambda z, right? So that's, I haven't written it out, but this should be a p lambda y, a p x, and a p lambda z in each of those boxes. And then the point is that what I did algebraically, I can do entirely in terms of a picture. I can say, well, those facts that I know about x, lambda y, and lambda z, then allow me to make inferences about y and z and the final x, right? So whatever I know about x, it's sort of equally pertinent to the, you know, what I should believe about x, but also it's pertinent to what I should believe about y, because whatever I know about x, you know, I know that about the input to this function f, and I know that about the input to this function g. So that's what this sort of copy operation over here means, that, you know, my knowledge of x pertains here. And so this inference here from x and lambda y to y is that deterministic inference we talked about last time. It's, you know, this is a deterministic function, so I can infer y perfectly from knowledge of these guys. So I just need to take my knowledge of lambda y, my knowledge of x, and this deterministic inference to compute what I should believe about y. And similarly here, to compute what I should believe about z. And then finally, I can absorb these probabilities into this box and make it now an indeterministic dependence, p of z given x, because I've marginalized over lambda z. And similarly on top, I marginalize over lambda y. Okay, so this is just another way of writing what we had before, which is that the joint distribution over x, y, z is obtained by this p of x and the conditionals y given x and z given x. Okay, so again, if I want to write down, you know, the structural equation model, it'll look something like this, and I have to stipulate these as parameters. But if I do it as a Bayesian causal model, I can say, no, I want to lump together this lambda z and this deterministic function just into an indeterministic dependence, p of z given x, and over on the left, p of y given x. And so now my parameters are just these three conditional probabilities. All right, so again, what does that look like in the DAG picture? You know, we saw this before in the simple example of x causing y. So things now look like follows. Over here for the structure equation model, you draw the DAG that's associated with this circuit. Y and Z are deterministic functions of their parents. And then my other parameters are the description of the statistical distributions of all these root variables. But if I want, I can just eliminate, I can marginalize over lambda Y and lambda Z and just stipulate the conditionals here. Because all I'm interested in this case is X, Y, and Z and what I believe about them. All right. One thing you should notice is that these Bayesian causal models are allowed to eliminate variables that are causes of one other variable. You can't eliminate unobserved variables that are common causes. So all we've been doing in the last couple of examples are eliminating things that only influence one other thing in your model and absorbing that into a sort of definition of a conditional, but you can't do that with the common causes. And so that means that all common causes of multiple variables in your model also have to be included in your model. They could be observed, they could be unobserved, but they have to be there explicitly. All right. And so that means that if you think about the variables that appear like in the DAG or in the wires of the circuit, they're the same as, they're the same as those that appear in the structural equation model. So of the variables that act as common causes, for example, of more than one variable, you're going to find the same ones over here as were over here. So in this example, X is a common cause in this model, so I can't ignore it here, and it's included in this Bayesian causal model. So only lambda Y and lambda Z, for instance, can be ignored in this case. Good. So now, with those two examples in hand, I want to go on and say, okay, what are the constraints that follow for any causal structure with, you know, any directed acyclic graph? Okay, so this is going to be just an example of a slightly more complicated graph where I have this Z that influences X that influences Y and W here that gets copied in influencing X and Y. And then, you know, to make this a deterministic model, X depends not just on Z and W, but on some other variables, U1. Here, Y depends on some other variables, U2. Okay, so that's a version of what I call the instrumental scenario in the first lecture. And so if I want to know what should I believe about all these four variables, W, Z, X, and Y, these are the parameters I would need to specify. The distributions over all these root variables and then these functional dependencies here. Okay, so the logic is going to be exactly the same, where you know the structure of the circuit here, the causal circuit, basically fixes the structure of my inferences, right? So if I know something about W, that information is going to be pertinent to sort of what I believe about W at the end of the day, but also about Y and X, because in the causal structure, W influences X and Y. So if you think of the, you know, what this structure looks like, turn it on its side, you get a similar structure here. You're replacing deterministic causal dependencies with deterministic inferences now. You're saying what I infer about X is dependent on what I know about Z, W, and U1. What I infer about Y depends on what I know about X, W, and U2. And all I'm doing is copying out Z and X and W so that I can have them left over at the end as to express my joint distribution. So this is, again, just a cartoon for what I could do algebraically. I could write down, you know, what should I believe about all four variables and show that it boils down to an expression that looks like this, right? So I've just lumped in this U1 and U2 with this deterministic dependence into some indeterministic conditionals here and here. And now this is the joint distribution. And the point is, do I have them both on the same slide? No, I don't. The point is that I can describe this conditional as every variable given its parents. It's the product of conditionals, every variable given its parents. So Y given X and W, Y has X and W as its parents after I've marginalized over U2. And X has Z and W as its parents. So that's why I have this term. And then Z and W are just parentless. So they appear as marginals in this expression. As a DAG, this thing looks like this. And I could just rewrite it in the DAG language with the functionals and these. And then, you know, if you really wanted to do it algebraically, you would do it exactly the same way we did the other example. Stipulate your inferences to be deterministic, lump things together to get the conditionals. And it always looks like this. So the causal structure always dictates the form that your inferences take. And if you allow for these stochastic maps by always marginalizing over the unobserved variables that only influence one other guy, ultimately you get the recipe that it's just the product of the conditionals of every variable given its parents. So this is, you know, another example. The general result is as follows. So first of all, terminology, if I say a probability distribution is compatible with a given causal structure, if there are parameters that yield it, meaning if there are a choice of the conditionals here such that when you multiply them out, you get that probability distribution, then we say that probability distribution is compatible with the structure. So here, if there's a, you know, for a given probability distribution over these four variables, if there's a choice of conditionals here that gives me that under this combination, I say that joint distribution is compatible. So then the general result is this, that if you've got a causal structure with n variables, x1 to xn, they're described by some directed acyclic graph G, some causal structure, then the set of distributions that are compatible with it are those that have this form. They're a product of conditionals of every variable given its parents in that causal structure. So as I vary over all choices of these conditionals, every variable given its parents, multiply them all together, I'll get the set of all distributions that are compatible with that causal structure. Okay, this is sometimes called the Markov condition. All right, so that's a pretty powerful result because now it means you can just take any circuit or equivalently any DAG and write down an expression for exactly which distributions are compatible with it. There's a couple of variants of this theorem. So there's something called the local Markov condition, which proves that if you have a causal structure G, then here's a fact that holds true of all the compatible distributions, which is that every variable is going to be independent of its non-descendants given its parents. Sorry, go ahead with your question. Yeah.
Slide, yep. Do you have a diagrammatic definition of this? Like, what does this mean in terms of symmetric monoidal?
Well, so back here, like when I have these kinds of diagrams, this is somehow representing that product. There's a bit of subtlety. These are really to be thought of as stochastic maps that take in distributions over W and Z and spit out a distribution over X. But I think I have an extra slide where I could show what it looks like. There's a way of rewriting this in the symmetric monoidal category where these maps turn into functions on the Cartesian product of these spaces, and that function gets multiplied times these. So there's some cups and caps in the symmetric monoidal category that will allow me to rewrite all of this as a product of a bunch of conditionals so that it looks more like this form. And so that would be the general form of this theorem, just a product of all those guys. Okay, so what this means is, so I've been using throughout the course just this language of family trees. The parents of a node in a causal structure or a wire are just the variables that influence it directly, you know, not its grandparents, not anything further back. Its descendants are its children and its grandchildren and everything that I can get to through a directed path. Its non-descendants are everything else, right? So if I exclude its descendants and its parents, you know, everything else is its non-descendants. So it's basically saying that once you know the values of variables' parents, you won't be able to learn anything more about everything else by learning X. Basically, its parents screen off X from everything that are its non-descendants. So the proof of that, you know, I can prove that starting from that Markov condition. So here PA and ND are just going to be shorthand for parents and non-descendants. So probability theory tells me that the conditional of X given parents and non-descendants, basically I want to show that that's going to be equal to just X given the parents, that basically learning the non-descendants doesn't teach me anything new about X. So that a conditional is just the joint over the marginal on the parents and the non-descendants. But by the Markov condition, this joint here can be written as the product of the conditionals of every variable in this full set here of these three guys given its parents. So that's X given his parents, and then all the Y among the parents of the non-descendants, the probability of that Y given its parents. But when I look at the denominator, it's the same thing. I have to take, for this, I have to take the product over all the Ys that are either in the parental set or the non-descendant set, product of these conditionals. But then these two terms cancel, and I just get this. Okay, so that's this condition. So it's, you can think of it as the local Markov condition, because it sort of tells you about a particular variable X and its relations to other things. So here's an example. It's just like an example I showed a few slides ago, but I didn't have time to replace all these numbered variables with A, B, C, D, E. So slightly different. But say you give me this causal structure, and you say, well, what follows from this local Markov condition? I can now just run through over all the variables. So let's take a look at X1. So what are the parents of X1? Answer, nothing. What are the non-descendants of X1? Well, all of these guys here, X4, X3, X5, they're all descendants of X1. So the only non-descendant of X1 is X2. So X1 is independent of X2. That's obviously right, because they have no common ancestors. So that's the first conditional independence. If I go to X2 now, I say, what are its parents? Answer, nothing. So there's a null, you know, I'm conditioning on the null set. It's just going to be a marginal independence. And then I say, what are its non-descendants? Well, X3 and X5 are both its descendants. So its non-descendants are X1 and X4. So I got this conditional independence. And it goes on like that. I'll do maybe one more. So X3 here has X1 and X2 as parents. So I'm going to condition on the set X1, X2. X5 is its descendant. X4 is its only non-descendant in the graph. So that's the conditional independence I get from the local Markov condition. Okay, so these are all constraints on the compatible distributions, the distributions that are compatible with this DAG. So the distributions on X1 to X5 that are compatible all satisfy these constraints. But remember from last lecture, there's these semi-graphoid axioms that say if certain conditional independences hold, then others will as well. And so if I take these and I ask, are there more conditional independences that follow from those semi-graphoid axioms? The answer is yes. So I can infer, for example, that X4 is independent of X2 given X1. Let's see. That's because, you know, I have this independence. And remember, you know, this kind of thing, if in the context of already knowing X1, learning X2 and X3 teaches me nothing new about X4, then learning X2 alone will teach me nothing new about X4 because I've learned less. That's all that this says. I've just dropped X3 to get here. And so, you know, you can go through and algorithmically apply all the semi-graphoid axioms and complete this list and get all the conditional independences that follow from the Markov condition. Yes? This one.
You're saying basically that X5 is losing all the memory about X1, X2 because of the principle that you postulate that you talked about, it has only been dependent on its immediate parents.
Mm-hmm.
So it's right. Losing doesn't this kind of limit
it can have information about X1, X2. The point, so that means, in other words, you know, the value of X5 could very well be correlated with X1, X2. It's just that if I already know the values of X3 and X4, and I ask, does learning the values of X1 and X2 teach me anything new about X5 once I know these values? The answer is no. They basically mean that I can't learn anything new about X5 from these variables once I already know these. So that's a screening off effect. I can't learn anything about this from these once I know this.
But could we also say that if x4 and x3, the only parameters they have is x1 and x2, can
yep.
we invert that and say x5 is independent of x3 and x2, provided that I know x1 and x2? So just invert the independence and the...
Yeah, so invert this guy and this guy, like say, so let's see. So if in the context of already knowing x1 and x2, is it the case that I could learn something new about x5 by learning x3 and x4? That's your question.
Yeah, that's so, only, yeah. x1 and x3 are only dependent on x1 and x2. There's nothing else.
If this is a deterministic dependence and so there's nothing else to know, then x3 and x4 could be proxies for x1 and x2. But this is why I introduced this distinction between the structural equation models and the causal Bayesian models. Here we're talking about causal Bayesian models where we're allowing these dependences to be indeterministic. And in that scenario, it very well could be that there's some other variables that influence x4 and x3 besides x1 and x2. And therefore, there's things about x3 and x4 that you don't know if you only know x1 and x2. And so learning x3 and x4 can teach you something new about x5. That's right. Yeah, things are quite different if you talk about the cases where you're really in the structural equation model where everything is a deterministic dependence. Okay. So this kind of way of finding conditional independence relations is kind of cumbersome. I mean, I've played around with the semigraphoid axioms, and they're not that easy to work with, even though individually each one is kind of intuitive. It's a bit hard. Like if you try to prove this using the semigraphoid axioms, it sort of requires a certain amount of creativity to say, all right, where should I start? Which axioms should I apply? But there's actually a nice way of just looking at the graph and figuring out whether a given conditional independence relation holds or not. So if somebody says, I want to know if this conditional independence relation holds in this graph, there's a nice convenient graphical criteria for deciding that. And it's called the deseparation criterion. And so this is a workhorse of causal inference. This is a really important concept that shows up all over the place in causal inference. So I want to explain what deseparation is. So as I said, it's this graphical criterion. And so I'm going to show you what it is in its full glory, but we're not going to dwell on it. I'm then going to kind of build it up from simple parts. And then we'll come back to it in its full glory, and you'll be able to appreciate it at the end. Why is it important? You know, the idea is that if X is deseparated from Y by Z in the causal structure, so this is a three-part relation among sets of nodes in the causal structure. So X, Y, and Z could be three individual nodes, and then it's a relation between three individual nodes. But I'm using bold X, bold Y, and bold Z because this could be a set of any number of nodes, this a set of nodes, and this a set of nodes. So it's really a three-way relation among sets of nodes. So whenever that graphical, a certain criterion I'm about to tell you holds, then you know that the joint distribution over all the nodes is such that you get factorization between the set X and the set Y when you condition on the set Z. Okay? So you can recover that conditional independence relation, meaning that conditional independence relation has to hold in every probability distribution that's compatible with that graph. So this is what it looks like. So this is the definition of deseparation, and it relies on a notion of paths between the sets of variables x and y. So you give me a set of variables x, a set of variables y, and they're deseparated by a third set of variables z, if and only if for every pair of vertices x and y that you draw from each of those sets, every path between that pair of variables is blocked by, a variable in z. This is fine. It is blocked, is correct. And then up here, this is the definition of what it means for a path to be blocked. So a path between node X and node Y is blocked by the set of vertices Z if at least one of the following conditions holds. And here they are. So the first condition is the path contains a chain, which I'll define in a moment, whose mediary node is in Z. The path contains a fork, whose tail node is in Z. Or the path contains a collider, whose head node is not in Z, and no descendant of which is in Z. Okay, so it's a little bit elaborate, but it's actually pretty straightforward once you sort of parse the meaning of these things. So let's go through each of these one case at a time. So let's start with the fork case. So that's a fork is just a triple. So if I imagine a sort of a path, which is just a kind of set of nodes in the graph, the arrows don't have to go in the same direction, but there's some set of nodes in the graph. And if somewhere in that set of nodes that are connected, I have this shape, then that's a fork. So Z influences X and Y. But this is exactly the case that we talked about earlier, where Z is a complete common cause of X and Y. Every fork has the feature that the complete common cause of the head of the fork is the tail of the fork. And so we already know that in that case, I have that X is independent of Y given Z, which I can write this way, meaning that if I already know everything there is to know about Z, learning X won't teach me anything new about Y, learning Y won't teach me anything new about X, so my beliefs won't propagate along that path if I already know Z. And so if there's other variables further on here, so something like X prime beyond X, Y prime beyond Y, it's also the case that learning X prime is not going to teach me about Y prime if I already know Z. Because the only reason that things over here have taught me about things over here is because of this common cause. And if I already know everything there is to know about this guy, then I'm not going to learn anything new by learning X or anything downstream of X. Okay, so simple example. In children, shoe size is correlated with reading ability, but that's because of the common cause of how old you are. So if you already know how old the child is, learning their shoe size is not going to help you make better predictions about their reading ability, because age will screen off that effect. All right, so that's the one we saw already. What about the chain? So this is a chain. So if I have a path and there's three nodes in the path that are related this kind of way, X influences Z influences Y. Well, then we get X independent of Y given Z, because if I think of applying the local Markov condition to Y, Z is the full set of parents of Y, and X is a non-descendant of Y. So Y should be independent of its non-descendants given its parents. So Y should be independent of X given Z. And that again makes sense that, although learning X could teach me something about Y, and learning Y could teach me something about X, if I already know everything about Z, then that's basically screening off my information. I'm not going to learn anything new about the thing on the other side of the chain. And if I add elements to the chain further on, so arrows into other variables, or other variables arrow into X, it's going to be the same thing. Nothing over here on this side is going to teach me anything about stuff over here if I already know Z. It's going to cut off all those inferences. All right, so a typical example would be something like, the smoke alarm is an indirect effect of fire via the existence of smoke. So, if I already know there's smoke, then, hearing the alarm hasn't taught me anything new, because the alarm is just responding to the smoke. Good. And then maybe the trickiest one is the collider. So this is the collider here, where you have a pair of variables that have a common effect, Z. So we know here that, so imagine that, this is part of a larger diagram. So here, X and Y, if they have no ancestors in common, then they're going to be independent when you marginalize over Z. In general, that might not hold true. The more important thing is that X and Y can become dependent if you condition on Z. So if I learn something about Z, suddenly I can induce correlations between X and Y. That's what's going to be important for deseparation. So let me give you one simple concrete example, and then some intuitive cases. If these are all binary variables, and say A is just uniformly distributed over its two values, similarly with B, and then suppose Z responds deterministically to A and B, and it's just like the AND gate, right? So Z is 1 if A and B are both 1, because this is a product. And if either A or B is 0, Z is 0. So I'm just flipping two coins, and then Z is reporting whether they're both heads or not. So in that case, if I ask what should I believe about A and B when I say learn that z is 0. Well, okay, I can just do the calculation. This is what Bayes' theorem tells me. You know, AB given z is z given AB times the marginal over AB divided by the marginal on z. This is the joint distribution over AB. It's just the uniform distribution over 2 bits. But if I take that uniform distribution over 2 bits and multiply by this conditional here, right, this Kronecker delta is only 1 when A and B are 0, because I'm imagining the case where I'm conditioning on z equals 0. So the only time when A times B will be 0 is for these 3 terms here and not for this term. So the 0 in the Kronecker delta kills this term. I renormalize and I get this. I get a uniform distribution over the 3 bit strings whose product is 0. So now the 2 bits are correlated, right? If you teach me, if I learn now that A is 1, for instance here, I can infer that B had to be 0, right? Now I have a correlation. Previously, I didn't, but I've induced one by virtue of learning what the common effect is. Is that clear? So like there's some famous examples of this kind of thing. It's kind of counterintuitive, so there's sometimes called Bergson's paradox. So if here's a question, you know, if you might ask, are teaching ability and research ability anti-correlated? Now, if you do a study and you say, okay, I'm going to look at only the faculty that have been hired into universities, I'm going to, you know, figure out how good their teaching is, how good their research is, you might see an anti-correlation, but it's not because, you know, being a good researcher makes you a bad teacher or vice versa. It could be that in the general population, there's sort of a uniform, it's uncorrelated. Let's say I have a uniform distribution over 2, you know, possibilities for teaching, good and bad, 2 possibilities for research, good and bad. So the whole thing's just a uniform distribution. But when I post-select on the faculty, well, because the hiring policies of universities would say, if they're both a bad teacher and a bad researcher, we don't hire them. So this guy's going to be excluded from the data set. So the only thing that's going to be in the data set are these 3. But it doesn't represent any sort of causal mechanism that forces good teachers to be bad researchers or vice versa. It's just by virtue of this limited set of data you have where you've post-selected on a certain subpopulation. So this is just like the coin flip example I showed, but it's, you know, in a real world setting. Another example that you'll see a lot is, you know, it might seem like, you know, good personality and good looks are anti-correlated, but if it's only because, you know, people will date someone only if they have a great personality or are good looking, then it means they're not going to have anybody in their sample who's, you know, in this region here, and so they'll get this anti-correlation, but it's not necessarily an anti-correlation that's there in the original population. It's just due to this post-selection effect. Okay, and then in the first lecture, I had this example here, which was that, you know, if low birth weight could be caused by being a smoker or other conditions, and then I find that somebody's a non-smoker, generally that'll lead me to assign a higher probability to other conditions when I already know that, you know, it's a low birth weight example. Okay, so this is why, you know, when we go back to the general case, if you have a if you're interested in making 2 variables independent, you know, you don't want a condition on the collider. That'll make them dependent. So back in the examples with the chain and the fork, let's go all the way back, right? You know, conditioning on the mediator in the chain makes these things independent. Conditioning on the head of the fork makes the tails independent. But not the case with the collider. So that's what we have to watch out for. And then there's one other thing we have to worry about, which is, you know, this is one of these Bayesian causal models, so all these dependences can be non-deterministic. And so if I learn about W, which is a descendant of Z, well, that can certainly teach me something about Z. And now I'm back to a situation where, you know, having learned something about Z, that can induce correlations between X and Y. So if I condition on W, I can also induce correlations between X and Y. Okay, so this is why we have these 3 conditions, right? So let's just take the case where X and Y and Z are individual variables. So if I have a path of variables between x and y, and somewhere in that path there's a chain of three variables where the mediary node is in z, it's something you're conditioning on. Well, then that I can't induce correlations between x and y via that path because I'm conditioning on this guy. If there's a path where there's a fork and the tail node, so the bottom of the fork, is in z, then I'm also going to not be able to induce correlations between x and y through that path. But if there's a collider somewhere in the path, and the top of the collider is now has to be not in z, because if it were in z and I condition on it, that would induce correlations. So it should be not in z, and no descendant of that collider should be in the set I'm conditioning on either. Okay, so I can't condition on collider heads or any descendants of them. So this is what we mean by a path is blocked, right? Basically, it has to be that I'm not inducing correlations by conditioning on a collider, and I have to be conditioning on, you know, it's enough to condition either on the mediary in a chain or the bottom node in a fork. Okay, so now the definition of deseparation is this. So again, let's start with just x, y, and z being three individual nodes. Two vertices x and y are deseparated by a vertex z if and only if every path between that pair of nodes, x and y, is blocked by z, right? So for every path you can identify between them, you know, that node z will block each one of those paths. And then, you know, the generalization to where these are sets just means that now take every pairing of a node from the set x and a node from the set y, find all the paths between that pair of nodes, make sure that something in the set Z blocks each one of those paths. All right, so let's maybe see, I'm gonna skip this for a minute, see like an example like this, all right? So lots of variables, here's X and Y. And now if you just say, well, what are the paths between X and Y? Well, you know, here's a path, here's a path, right? So it just has to be a set of nodes that are pairwise connected. The arrows don't have to run in the same direction. So like this path has two arrows pointing into J. You know, here's another path here. If I go down the bottom, you know, there's another path here. And then there's this top path, right? Okay, so these are all the paths that connect X and Y. So now I can say, all right, well, what sorts sets of variables can block inferences from X to Y? So in general, X and Y are going to be correlated. All right, so if I look at the top path and I say, do I have to condition on something to block inferences from X and Y? No, because as long as I'm not conditioning on L or K, then there won't be any induced correlation between X and Y. So if I'm marginalizing over L and K, meaning I'm not conditioning on them, then this path is not going to induce correlations between X and Y. Of course, if my set Z does include K or L, well, then that path is unblocked, and I don't have a conditional independence, X independent of Y given Z. Okay, what about, you know, say this path here? Well, you know, if I condition on H or G or F, each one of these, H is part of a chain, you know, inside the path, G, H, Y is a chain. So if I condition on H, I can break the correlation between X and Y. So if H was in the set Z, that would deseparate, that would block this path here. Similarly with G, it would block the path, similarly with F. But if I look at this path here, for example, well, it doesn't need to be blocked because it has a collider at J, right? So it's enough for me to condition on H, you know, that blocks this path, and this path is already blocked. So, you know, I don't, for example, need to condition on G to block this path, right? It's a way of blocking this path, but I don't really require it. I could condition on it or not. Doesn't matter. And then, you know, if I do something like, oh, I don't know, what's a good example here? Say I condition on B. So that will block this path, right? So if I look at inferences from X to Y via, you know, A, B, and H here, well, B is part of a chain, A, B, H. That's part of that path, so conditioning on B will block that path. But it's also the head of a collider between A, B, and C, and so it unblocks this path, right? By learning B, conditioning on B, you induce correlations between A and C, which ultimately can induce correlations between C and X and Y, and therefore X and Y generally won't be independent given B. Okay, so you gotta make sure that your set Z doesn't include B because that will unblock this path. But it could include B as long as it also includes, for example, D and E, because now you're blocking that path again, right? If I condition on D, this path becomes blocked. So this is kind of the details of that condition, the deseparation condition. You have to go find all the paths, make sure that your set of variables Z manages to block every path between X and Y. Okay? So now when you have this tool, you can go back to this example we saw, where was it? With the semigraphoid axiom. This one here. So x4, x5, independent of x2, given x1, x3. So we say, all right, let's look. x2 is here, x4 and x5 are here. And the question is, are they deseparated from one another in this graph, given x1 and x3? So does somebody want to volunteer an explanation of why that independence, conditional independence holds?
X2 will not reach X5.
So wait, hold on. Which path are you talking about? Right. Okay. So in this case, you want to say, what are all the paths from, say, X2 to X5? So you'd have this path and this path. And then if you ask, what are all the paths from X2 to X4? You have, again, a pair of paths, this path and this path. Okay. So you're talking about the path between X2 and X5 that goes through X3?
Yeah. Well, that's a chain.
That's a chain, yeah. Right. So on this path here, if you just conditioned on X3, this path would not be blocked, right? You would expect learning X4 to teach you something about X4.
But if you conditioned on X1 as well,
right?
That path would be blocked.
Because this is, yes, exactly, because this is part of a fork. And so it's all right that you're conditioning on X3 because you're also conditioning on X1. So that settles why X2 and X5, all their paths are blocked. So now you have to ask the same question about X2 and X4. So you can say, all right, here's the path from X2 to X4. I'm not conditioning on X5, so it's already blocked, right? I don't need to do anything else. X5 is a collider, I'm not conditioning on it. That means everything else is going to be independent. And then there's this path here. If I conditioned on X3, that would unblock the path. It would make X2 and X4 correlated, but I'm also conditioning on X1, so I'm okay. So this is the sense in which, rather than applying a whole bunch of semigraphoid axioms, you can just go apply the deseparation criterion, look at all the paths, see if every one of them is blocked, and conclude what the conditional independence, whether a given conditional independence relation holds or not. Okay, so in your first problem set, there's going to be an example where you have to work out some deseparation relations for the Bell DAG. Okay, so let me go back to where we were. So the point is that, you know, you can easily test this kind of condition. When you find three sets of variables that satisfy this deseparation relation, you know that the conditional independence holds for every distribution that's compatible. Just here's a small note, which is that it can be possible for two sets of variables to be deseparated by the empty set, meaning, you know, they're all paths between them are blocked by conditioning on nothing, right? So like, for example, the tails of a collider, you know, if this is my graph, they are deseparated by the empty set because the only path between them here is blocked by virtue of the fact that I'm not conditioning on Z. Okay. sometimes, this is just terminology. If you have a distribution and it satisfies all the conditional independence relations, that are implied by a DAG, right? So all the ones that come out of deseparation relations. Then we say that that distribution is Markov relative to the graph. What we're going to see in cases like the Bell scenario and the instrumental scenario, that there are other constraints besides these conditional independences. But if you're just asking, whether something's ruled out by virtue of not having the right conditional independences, the jargon is you're saying that it's not Markov relative to the graph, okay? Or is incompatible with the graph by virtue of violating some conditional independence relations that are implied by that graph. This was the example we just went through. So I don't need to do that again. And that's where I wanted to end the story about deseparation. So I had one other topic I wanted to introduce today, but let me just pause and see if there's any questions about deseparation that remain.
Can you just really fast go through the collider again? Yep.
Do you mean like how it appears in the definition?
Yeah.
Okay. So you have to have at least one of these conditions holding. So if it happens, let's look at the third condition, that the path contains a collider and the head of that collider is not in your conditioning set and no descendant of it is in your conditioning set, then your X and your Y are that path between X and Y is blocked. There's no way that learning about X is going to teach me about Y, because although I could induce correlations by conditioning on the head of the collider, right? That would induce correlations. If I'm not doing that, if it's not in the conditioning set, I'm not going to be inducing those correlations. And although I could induce correlations by conditioning on a descendant of that guy, if I'm not doing that, then I'm okay, and that path is blocked. So like in my example, with the big graph here, if the set Z you're interested in happens to include K or L, that will unblock the path between X and Y. But if K and L are not included in Z, then this path is taken care of. It's already blocked just by virtue of the fact that L and K, the only collider on this path is K, and L is a descendant of it. By virtue of them not being in the set Z, this path is already blocked. I don't need to condition on I or J as well, right? The path is already blocked. I can condition on I and J because all this thing said was that at least one of these conditions has to hold for every path. It's fine if two, if it's both no collider or descendant of a collider is in the set. And furthermore, I'm also conditioning on things that are part of the mediator of a chain inside that set. That's fine. Just means I'm satisfying multiple conditions, and in any case, that path is blocked. Other questions? Yeah. Yes, yes. Exactly. So yes, in a upcoming lecture, I'm going to go into more detail about how there's rules that use deseparation that tell you, like, if I want to know what the do conditional, Y given do X is, but there's a whole bunch of pathways between X and Y, then I don't want to be conditioning on things that are sort of on the direct causal pathway between them. But things that are like common causes of X and Y, I want to go and condition on the mediaries or the forks so that I don't see any correlations that are due to those common causes. And I certainly don't want to go and, let's say there's a path that has a collider on it, I don't want to go condition on those because then I'm going to get these spurious correlations that are only due to post-selection. So yeah, the rules for figuring out how to deduce the influence of X on Y in some complicated graph make heavy use of deseparation. And I was just giving sort of a taste in that first lecture, but we'll come back to it. Okay. Yeah, go ahead.
This is regarding the Bayesian tag. So I'm guessing that you're not specifying all the parents of the node of a given thing. But so let's say Z is a parent of W and X is a parent of Z.
Yeah. No, so I have a picture of a chain, so I can just point at it. where is it? Here we go. So if in a Bayesian causal model I say this is my hypothesis about the causal structure, then I'm certainly stipulating that y does not have a direct dependence on x, right? So if I were to embellish this graph with some extra nodes that point into just a single node, so there's sometimes people do this, there's a noise variable for y, call that lambda y, it just points into y. There's a noise variable for z, lambda z, points into z. Those are the kinds of things I can rule out, but a direct arrow from x to y, if it's there in the structural equation model, where everything's deterministic, it will persist in the Bayesian causal model as well. So, if I have that alternative with the direct arrow, then z would not make x and y independent because it's not not screening them off, right? It's, when I look at this condition, the local Markov condition, the parents of y would now be z and x, not z alone. And so y does not become independent of x given its parents, x has to be included among its parents. Okay. Good. Other questions about D separation? All right. So in the last little bit, I want to talk about different ways of sort of probing the variables in a causal structure. So to do that, I need one extra little piece of diagrammatic notation, which is this little ground symbol from electronics. And that basically means, this variable here, this wire in the circuit, I'm not going to consider it anymore. It's not going to be relevant for any future causal processes. And so, for example, if I've got, y and z depending functionally on x, and then I decide to not look at z anymore, ultimately I'm just picking out y is dependent on x, the function f. So, for instance, if I have a copy operation and I ignore one of the copies, well, that's like doing nothing at all to the first system, right? Because this is a copy operation, this left-hand guy tracks the first guy. So this is like an identity operation. So that's just going to be useful in these circuit diagrams. Like here, this instrumental scenario circuit, if I say at the end of the day, I'm not going to feed y into anything else, I can just put that ground symbol on top of y and say that I'm going to ignore it from now on. Okay, so a probing scheme is going to be I imagine like this might be the natural thing that's going on in the world. And for every one of the variables that I'm interested in, so in this case that's going to be x, y, z, and w, I can imagine sort of opening up that wire and doing something there, right? And that could be just observing, or it could be intervening, re-randomizing, all that kind of stuff. So it's going to be important that actually we give different names for the wires that are input into this sort of probing locus, and the wire that gets output. So I'll call the input wire z and the output wire z sharp. So they're sort of the counterparts of z, but in a scheme where I'm now allowing this kind of surgery on nature, I'm changing things. I might be doing a randomized controlled trial rather than letting people decide for themselves. Okay, so you're gonna open up the wires, and there is a kind of way of doing this in the DAG notation where for every node, you split it into a couple of nodes. But actually, the DAG notation is going to be a bit cumbersome or not so useful for these kinds of distinctions I'm about to tell you. So it's one of the reasons that circuits are a little bit easier to work with. Because there are many different types of probing schemes. So I'm not going to give you a full accounting. These are the three that we're going to worry about for now. So the one we've mostly been talking about or aiming towards is just observation. So I can think of that this way. Into this locus comes the variable x, I make a copy of it, and then I leave it as is, so x sharp is just a copy of x as well. So that's something I do physically, causally, like if I want to at any point do a statistical study, I have to measure variables, I have to learn about them and make a record. And so you can think of this extra copy as that's my record, some system that's a proxy to that variable, it's recorded what its value was. So if I want to study the effect of the weather forecast on people's behaviors, I have to have a copy of the weather forecast myself that I can correlate with people's behaviors. Okay, if I do nothing, right, so if I basically just marginalize over a variable, it means I'm not copying it, I'm just letting it continue like in the natural experiment. So when we talk about, if I've got all these variables, and I could measure that guy in principle, or maybe I have, but I'm just not even paying attention to it. You know, you can think of that this way. It's just the natural experiment where you are not conditioning on the value of this variable. You're not looking at it. And then finally, there's intervention, where you learn, you're going to both learn the value that the variable would have taken, but the output of the node is not allowed to be a copy of that. You now make a new copy, chosen at random by some distribution, keep a copy of that yourself, and then feed it in to the rest of the circuit. So this is like the randomized control trial. I might register whether somebody wanted to take the drug or not, and then I say, well, regardless of whether they wanted to or not, I flip a coin here to decide whether they're going to get the placebo or the drug, and I now give them the treatment that the coin flip decided, and I record whether they got the treatment or the placebo. Okay. In some cases, you might not care to register what the preference was, and you might just sort of ignore this, and then you'd have another kind of intervention scheme where you're sort of randomizing and not keeping track. But I'm going to use this one as the default because it's more powerful for figuring out what the causal structure is to keep that information around. Good. And as I said, I mean, there's more general types of things you can imagine. And this question about what do our probing schemes look like is going to come back again when we talk about quantum causal models, where things are going to look a bit different. Yes?
What is that slide doing exactly? You're saying,
yeah,
so when X goes into that box, that flag is randomly assigning, so X sharp could be either X itself or something that is not X.
I mean, maybe the confusion is I notice here that my superscript sharp has kind of fallen down, but this is an X sharp. So what I'm doing is I'm sampling some variable totally independently of X and feeding it in to that node, right? So like if I consider like over here, say this node here, I can imagine that I've got this new X sharp and I'm feeding it into the rest of the circuit and I'm keeping a copy of it. But it has nothing to do with the value that X took. Right, so I'm essentially cutting the causal influence here. I'm not letting X influence X sharp at all in an intervention because X is being put down in my lab notebook, but what goes forward, what's in black here, that's going to the rest of the experiment, that only depends on this process here, which is in my control as the experimenter. Yes, no, you're right. Sorry, I didn't notice that. I know when that happened, but I failed to notice it. Yeah, in a way, what I've done here with the color scheme, by the way, is like red is sort of what's in the experimenter's control, whereas black is sort of the natural process in the rest of the circuits. So the black things are what get fed into the rest of the circuit. Okay, good. So let's consider what these different schemes look like in this kind of example. So suppose I focus on a terminal node like Y, right? So it's terminal in the sense that it has no children in the causal model. So this is what an observational scheme looks like. I'm just going to learn why. And of course, the fact that I don't care about anything that happens down the road means it really doesn't matter what's going on with Y sharp. Learning Y can teach me something about, this causal mechanism and maybe things about other causal mechanisms. And so that's all I really care about. If I intervene on Y instead, well, I'm just, randomly distributing Y sharp and learning about it, but it's irrelevant, right? Because that nothing's happening there. So I may as well not do that. For terminal node, it makes no sense to intervene, right? It has no children, so you're not going to learn anything. So you may as well do an observation on any terminal node. There's no point intervening. What about a root node, one that has no parents in the model? So W and Z are examples. This is what observation would look like. I make a copy of W, make a copy of Z, write this down in my notebook. Intervention looks like this, where now I get a copy W, W sharp, Z, Z sharp. Well, all that's changed is that the distribution from which I sampled has gone from being the natural one here to whatever it is in my randomization procedure. So as long as the natural experiment was sort of sampling all the possibilities for W that I care about, I gain nothing really by sort of resampling that and feeding that in. Maybe the natural distribution made some values very infrequent, and I would have some advantage by sort of making those values more frequent by resampling them. But ultimately, in terms of what in principle I can infer about what everything else is going on, I don't get much of an advantage by doing an intervention. So basically, observation is essentially just as good as intervention for these root nodes as well. Note that there's really no point in calling one of these W sharp and the other W when all I'm doing is observing and this is just a copy. So you may as well just continue calling it W in that circumstance. The case that's interesting is when you got one of these mediary nodes like X. So now when you observe and you make a copy of X, you have the problem that, you know, you look at a correlation between X and Y. Suppose you've observed Y as well. You see a correlation. But you don't know whether that correlation is telling you about the influence, the cause-effect influence of X on Y, or just about the correlation to X and Y that's induced by this common cause of W. So that's a situation where observation doesn't serve you so well. Whereas if you intervene, and now you have two variables, X sharp and X, well, the correlation to X sharp and Y tell you about this causal process. The correlations between X and Y tell you about the common cause. And so intervention is really useful and is very powerful when you're looking at these mediaries because it really splits it into two variables, one of which teaches you about the past, the other of which teaches you about the future of that variable. Good, okay, so if you have the power to do interventions, then basically you can sort out the different conditional probabilities of all these different variables. So, you know, the standard example of the drug trial, which I brought up in the first lecture, is an example where, you know, you're assigning some treatment or a placebo, and you might record people's treatment preference. When you see the correlation between the sign, you know, getting the drug and recovering, you know there's some causal effect. And if you cared, you might say, oh, I wonder what would have happened if we hadn't done the randomized control trial. I wonder if, for example, you know, the men would have been more likely to take the drug than the women, and I would have seen a correlation regardless. Well, I can infer that if I record people's treatment preferences. I can sort of learn if there's a common cause correlation between people's preference of this drug and their recovery. Generally, we don't care about that information, but it's more information I could learn about this kind of mechanism, for example, here. Not the effectiveness of the drug, but whether there's a gender preference for taking this drug. I can learn that as well. Okay. So I think we mentioned before that if you are back in one of these structural equation models rather than a Bayesian causal model and you have a deterministic mechanism, then, you know, intervening is very powerful because you can now learn everything there is to know about the function. So if like Y is a deterministic function of X and I intervene on X, I can sort of really learn what that function is. I set X to all of its possible values in different interventions and learn what the value of Y is in each case. But typically, you know, Y depends on more than just X. So for example, whether I recover depends on more than whether I've got this drug. It depends on lots of other variables, my gender, my constitution, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, that's why there's this U2 here, which covers a lot of stuff. So in general, you're not going to learn about the function dictating how a recovery depends on everything. You're just going to learn about the conditional probability of recovery given drug, where you know you remain ignorant of a whole bunch of other factors. Good. So that just means you know we only learn what I call the do conditional last lecture. All right. So to sum up, you know, if you do intervene on all the variables in your network, you know, this is just an example, but you can think of any network, then you really do have the power to sort of extract out the conditional probabilities associated with all the different parts of that causal network. So you can, you know, you might not learn exactly what the distribution of the functions are. Like we mentioned in the case of the first lecture, there's sort of ambiguity about which mixtures of functions lead to a given stochastic matrix. But you can figure out what those stochastic matrices are. And I think would it be all right if I went a couple more minutes? I know we're a bit over time, but that's okay. So let me just finish with you know the case that most of our discussions concern, which is passive observation. Okay, so you know in the simplest case, where this is the causal structure, you know, a passive observation scheme is one where I make a copy of X. So I have that available at the end of the experiment. It's not just something that influenced Y, it's something that I have a copy of, I've registered. This is the way we tend to denote the difference between variables I'm observing and keeping a record of and variables I'm not in the DAG formalism, that we have to distinguish the nodes somehow. So like the circuits are nice because I can sort of tell you, oh yeah, I've made a copy of this, and you, I haven't. Whereas here, I don't have that flexibility, so generally you have to come up with some new notation for the variables that you're not observing and the variables that you're observing. So you'll see, like in my first lecture, I had some examples of variables that were unobserved. Here in circuits, it just means that they're sitting there and they're a closed wire. They don't come out at the end. So in a structural equation model, you know, in the circuit framework, if I say, well, I'm interested in knowing, I might be interested in knowing the distribution over U, X, and Y, in which case in this formalism, I would sort of put blue lines on all of them and say, please give me the joint distribution over X, U, and Y that this causal model predicts. But if I ultimately want to match those predictions up with relative frequencies of things I've observed, then I say, I want to predict the joint probability distribution on the things I'm observing, which in this case is just X and Y, not U. U is not observed in this experiment. So then I want to ask this kind of question. What kind of joint distribution X and Y is predicted by this causal model? You know, that's just this thing here. And you know, over in the DAG side, we just, you know, we color X and Y. Those are the ones that we're observing. So we just want to know what's the marginal on X and Y. So although you can compute the joint distribution over all of these, generally you want to compute the distribution for the marginal corresponding to what you're observing, because that's what you're going to compare with your statistical data. That's how your statistical data is going to allow you to falsify certain causal hypotheses in favor of others. Okay, so in other words, I mean, we set up a formalism that really allows me to talk about my knowledge about anything, but when we start engaging with experiment, we're going to focus on our knowledge of the stuff that's sort of coming out of our probing schemes, the Y and the X that we've observed. I guess I should mention that I didn't bother to copy Y because Y is terminal here, so he just comes out as an observation. Okay, if I'm not doing structural equation models but Bayesian causal models, it's kind of a similar story, that the U that I'm not observing has already been absorbed into this parameter, PY given X. And so, you know, I don't have any colored nodes left over here if I'm, you know, just using the conditionals. But in other cases where the thing that I am not observing is a common cause, like a common cause of X and Y, this lambda here, then it persists, right? So even in the Bayesian causal model, I can't eliminate these guys. It's not just influencing one. So he's an unobserved variable that influences multiple different variables. So I'm into using, here I'm using the conditional probabilities rather than deterministic dependences. But they can depend on lambda, which is not observed, and therefore, when I compute the distribution over the observed guys, I'm marginalizing over lambda. Okay, good. So this gets us back to the first lecture. So when on the first lecture, I wrote down this. This is a causal model. There's the DAG. This means unobserved. Here are the parameters. This is the joint distribution over the things I observe, X, Y, and Z. That's basically where we got to at the end of today, right? So this is why we're focused on this. We've lost some information about the functions because we're focusing on these conditionals, but we can certainly compare the relative frequencies of what we observe with the distributions that are compatible with this DAG. It's the same thing for the triangle. You know, it's just the product of all these parameters marginalized over the things that are not observed. The Bell structure, the same thing. On the first lecture, we talked a bit about the Bell structure with an extra arrow and what it looked like. And for these two, you're going to find that there are non-trivial conditional independence relations that hold. In the problem set, you're going to be asked to try to find some of those guys. So you can use deseparation to do that. And that's it for today. Sorry for going over time.